Hi guys, tonight's episode is one I recorded initially about 18 months ago, but for some reason I didn't have time to put it out in the first season of the podcast. However, with spring upon us, I think it's quite aptly timed that we release it now. All of the material in the second season of the podcast has been based around Cheshire, but this episode takes us over into Derbyshire, which was much more of a focus of the first season. Anyway, I hope you enjoy. Welcome to the Local Myth Historian Podcast with me, Eli Lewis Lysett, where we look at the extraordinary local histories of Cheshire, Derbyshire and Staffordshire. In this episode, we're discussing a local Derbyshire tradition. Well dressing is a much-loved local custom which enjoys an almost exclusive patronage in the county of Derbyshire. Its origins, however, are much debated and appear to be forever shrouded in the region's ancient past. Yet when we strip away the layers of tradition involved in the ceremony itself and consider the area's Roman history, an enticing possibility begins to emerge. Local tradition can be a wonderfully odd thing. Much like folklore, original meaning is often mistranscribed and direct origins impossible to uncover. As a result, modern rites and rituals conspire to create entirely separate traditions from those which went before, no less loved by local observers, but ultimately lovingly misunderstood. In some ways, this can be seen as a telescopic view of our broader British customs and celebrations. It's hard to find a Christian festival that isn't a superimposition of a far earlier seasonal pagan event. Easter, with its story of resurrection and rebirth, is a great example of this. With virtually every indigenous European culture that came to find themselves beneath the yoke of the Roman Empire, and therefore Roman Catholicism, sharing similar springtime festivals which celebrate the rebirth of the year following the death and darkness of winter. The timing of Christmas too is in this very vein, with an ancient festival of light and fire inspired by the winter solstice being a common trait amongst subservient early Roman Christian communities. On a local level, though, these traditions are less about the adaptation of existing festival days and more about the reshuffling of the pack of distant beliefs and superstitions. Some of these events, most, I dare say, have cause to make us smile. Cheese rolling competitions born from half-remembered ancient stories of the devil cursing the cows of the village. Strange tales all paired with homemade lemonade, charity fetes and tombola prizes. And just like folklore, these traditions are safely passed forward to future generations by the very virtue of their mutations. A process in which the tradition is observed far more because it's a tradition and far less due to the actual fears and beliefs that first inspired them into existence. Yet at the heart of these traditions, which we may on occasion glimpse by considering the wider context of their regional history, we can sometimes find a prism through which we might view our own local heritage in a way that's different to that which we otherwise would. And this podcast is about one such tradition, a tradition which exists almost entirely within the borders of Derbyshire's Peak District, to which thousands of people pledge their time and energy every year. As winter turns to spring, there are a host of rituals we will find littered throughout our daily lives, often without thinking of them as such. Easter will bring its bunnies and eggs, May Day, its fairs and gatherings. And alongside these traditions in the Peak District, so too the issue of annual wild dressing celebrations will no doubt have been on the minds of church committees and community groups since the turn of the year. In more than 100 locations in towns, villages and hamlets alike, this is a time when locals will gather together in a ceremony designed to assure holy protection of the local water supply. Many of these events have come to be tightly bound to local churches, and so today the events have very much the feel of a Christian celebration. And although there's a variance in the exact date that the ceremonies take place, broadly speaking being spread between May and September, the core rituals and principles are the same. Taking around a week to prepare, wet clay is spread across a large wooden board, sometimes up to 6 feet high, before flower petals and other totems of nature are built up into an elaborate design. The clay is kept damp through the process to avoid cracking, meaning it's a procedure that takes hundreds of work hours to complete. And once ready, the creation is placed at the community well and blessed by a local church official. Then it's time for a week's worth of celebrations, the climax of which often takes the air of a carnival and may well involve the crowning of a local child as the official wild queen. A view that's become popular in recent years is that the whole tradition of wild dressing is bound to a time of plague, with the village of Tissington believed to have dressed its well following the Black Death of the 14th century. Other sources point to the events surrounding the village of Eyam and the plague in 1665, but really, these are little more than natural assumptions, as there's little official record. That isn't, however, to say we can't dig a little deeper in search of an origin. The first recorded mention of wild dressing comes from 1758, with a record of the laying of garlands at the well in Tissington. But local law across the peaks had, by that time, established the practice as having been in place for as long as common memory could recall. To my mind, the specific association with the village of Eyam is a stretch, the residents of Eyam having become affected with plague following a bundle of cloth being received from London by a local tailor, took the decision to isolate themselves from the surrounding area in an attempt to stop a further spread into the north of England. Around a quarter of all the local inhabitants of the village lost their lives in the process. So that such a service of blessing should grow in the surrounding villages is certainly plausible. But curiously, in a place so well acquainted with its own plague history, where individual graves are remembered to this very day, there's no story associated with the village wells and their part in the village's survival. And after all, as we can all appreciate, water is somewhat naturally abundant across the peaks, falling from the sky on an almost daily basis, even in summer. So I think that we can rule out the plague as an origin for well dressing. Yet the fact remains the tradition of well dressing in the peaks is such a unique curio that it is as remarkable a thing to behold today as its origins are to consider. So to get a useful view, we need to strip back the layers on the topic of well dressing and see just what the process reveals beneath. The implication, far less palatable than we might wish to acknowledge, a child being brought forth, specially dressed and presented to a specific site to in some way encourage good fortune of the community, is a Christianized memory of ritual sacrifice. I think though it's just an adaptation of the May Queen more than anything else, so let's put that to one side, along with all those post-Enlightenment traditions regarding the particulars of the well-dressing backboard. The use of clay is likely only present due to it being the most adaptable natural construction material available in the region. When we do this, we are left with a focused, specific region of Britain consisting of less than 500 square miles, in which the primary cultural bond of ritual is the veneration of the places where water rises from the earth below. Once we clear the pomp and ceremony away, we see that well dressing ultimately is not a ceremony of thanksgiving for the water supply, rather it's the veneration of the water source itself, something which has been held firm across the peaks for more than 2,000 years. In 43 CE, when Rome finally invaded Britain, the island was a patchwork of local kingdoms ruled by various Iron Age tribes, unified only by an island-wide respect for the Druidic order that made for their highest forms of administration, law, and religious tradition. By 69 CE, the Roman curtain had extended up through the Midlands and now found itself also containing the lands we think of as the Peak District today. To cement their rule, successful settlement was not only dependent on military might and organisation, but also on the Roman willingness to adopt local practices, traditions and rituals. The venerated sites of a tribe, and therefore their deities and gods, was central to this process. Rome, like Iron Age Britain, was a pagan culture with a polytheistic approach to worship. Acknowledging multiple gods and goddesses in relation to a territory was not only good politics, it was also very much of a genuine belief structure. In the pagan mind, a mountain or river, even a simple group of rocks, could all quite legitimately be overseen by a specific local deity. As Rome began to build trade and administrative networks throughout the new territory, they would typically utilize two key techniques. Local populations that existed in an organized form that we might recognize as a town or village would be resettled into new, formulated, planned garrison towns. The sooner this happened, the sooner the locals would get on board with the new rules, and sooner, frankly, they would start paying tax. In addition to this, Rome needed to build forts at strategic points in the landscape, be them river crossings, mineral-rich geologies, or purely militaristic outposts. In the Peak District, this process had resulted in several new settlements. There was Navio near Hope, and Melandra near the modern town of Glossop. Chief amongst them, however, was Aquis Arnimeta, where the Romans had discovered something quite extraordinary. It was a place with a unique feature that they will find in only one other location on the entire island: natural thermal springs. Today, that settlement is known as the town of Buxton. And as today, with Buxton Water, Aquis Arnimeta, the waters of Arnimeta, would become famous the world over for the quality of its spring water. Arnimeta was a Romano-British goddess of the sacred grove, a variation on a pre-Roman indigenous local deity with whom the incoming Roman population had struck up a bond. The new town soon began to prosper as a bath town, located at the confluence of several major roads, including Batham Gate heading into South Yorkshire, the Street heading to Derbyshire, and other routes out through the Goyt Valley to Condate or modern-day Northwich. During the 1970s, an excavation at the site of the Roman bathhouse, under what is today the Crescent in Buxton, uncovered more than 200 Roman coins spanning almost 300 years of occupation. And in 122 CE, it's recorded that Emperor Hadrian himself visited. In fact, so well established had Roman Buxton become that more than 250 years after Roman forces retreated from Britain, the town was included in the Ravenna Cosmography, an atlas of all the places in the world known to Rome. That the springs were so enamouring to the incoming Romans was no surprise to the people of the peaks. Rising from a kilometre within the earth, the mineral water that reaches the surface at around 27 degrees had been doing so for around 3,000 years before the Romans arrived. The Celts had been venerating this place long before the Romans, and a temple dedicated to Iona, the Celtic goddess of healing waters, was noted on the site of the Bath Gardens back in 1755. This sense of identity would give both the immediate inhabitants of the town and those of the landscape around it a significant bond. During this period in which the security of the wider region was still in flux, the goddess of the springs would have been a constant in the minds of the Romans. It is she to whom they would have given their offerings and said their prayers, who would protect them and give them spiritual succour. She was now their goddess. As travellers reached the town from Derby, Manchester, Chester, London even, they would have known they were entering the realm of the water goddess. The cult of Arnimeta had been born. This process of assimilation is far from unusual. Throughout the Roman Empire, it's precisely the way in which populations became synthesized between the old world and the new. For those living in outlying settlements across the Peak District, infusing their identity with this new goddess was the manner by which their communities related to the centralized world of Romano Britain. Perhaps then, it's a matter of logic that when the goddess you worship is associated with the spring waters, and the town that guarantees your safety is named after her, that your own local wellspring should be the most direct portal you have to foster that connection. That there would have been a closely tied culture of veneration between the spring water of Buxton and the spring water of the wells shooting up from the earth and its surrounding landscape is a striking possibility, and one to which I look in search of an origin for the ceremony central to the peace. As time moved on and the Romans retreated, leaving behind Romano-British communities that had grown and matured across a 400-year time span, well veneration would have already begun its first transitions into the world of Romano-Christianity. Then, with the incoming incursions of Angles, Danes, Saxons, that would eventually result in both the Danelaw of the northern peak frontier and the borderlands of Anglo-Saxon Mercia within it, new ideas and traditions would naturally once more impact the meaning of local rituals in the Peak District. For pagans and Christians alike, the veneration of their holy water sites was perhaps one of the few rituals that all would have an interest in observing. and therefore preserving too. At first, it may have appeared that we are dealing with rituals, beliefs, and customs that sit the better part of 2,000 years apart. And the history of the town of Buxton, built both figuratively and literally at the well of the goddess Arnimita, or Arnimetai, Roman pronunciation is not my strong point, that the whole thing is little more than an interesting coincidence in relation to the lost origins of Peak District well dressing. But what a coincidence it would have to be. A local population tethered for more than 400 years to the image of a water goddess that is unique in the entirety of the Roman Empire goes on to establish a quasi-ritualistic, unfailing annual tradition of veneration for their local water wells. I mean, this is precisely how folklore, or rather in this case, folk tradition, works. And I'd leave you with this. Outside of the Peak District, well dressing as a modern tradition may have crossed the neighbouring borders of the Staffordshire Moorlands at Hendon and South Yorkshire at Wakeley, but little further. That is, except for in the county of Somerset, 200 miles southwest of the peaks, where there is a small group of similar rituals performed, all within a 15-mile radius from the city of Bath, that other, more obviously named, spa town of Roman Britain. Where Buxton was once Aqua Arnimeta, the city of Bath was once Aqua Sulis. The local population there too, via the mechanisms outlined here, would have had an intrinsic affinity with their own god of the local waters. That these two areas, so far apart, should share such a rare tradition, having owed their very creation to the fame afforded to them by their Roman-era status as centres of water healing, is perhaps proof that old habits don't always die hard. Sometimes they simply don't die at all. You can read more about my investigation into the wild dressing origins in Peak Derbyshire in my book, Mythstoric Origins, which is available via my website, thelocalmythstorian.com, or indeed on Amazon. It's been a pleasure. Until next time.